Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is going to be an empowering hour. I can promise you that brand new, important information on health, healing, anti-aging, reversal of disease. Plus, I'm going to be taking your calls on a line. And this line, you can voicemail line, call in anytime you want, 24/7, ask your calls, make a statement. The statement should be one that empowers people. And if it is, it'll get on. And that number to call in with your questions is 862-800-6805. Again, any questions you have, if I can answer them, I will. 862-800-6805. We're also going to have one audio clip today, and that will be from Tucker Carlson. Some things I agree, some I disagree, but he raises important issues on how leaders, all leaders, show no obligation to their own voters. They promise the world, get into office, and then do just the opposite. We pay attention, and I think it's time that we looked at a new body politic. I also believe we need new parties, people's parties, populist parties, justice parties, and in addition to the Green Party, which has been there a long time but hasn't registered with a lot of people. Tomorrow, one of the heads of the Green Party and the one who ran on its last ticket with Jill Stein will be here because there's a major new green incentive being promoted in Washington. The trouble with the Green Party and the people actually created it are not recognized, given no credit. Well, what does this tell us about the people promoting it? Just another group of narcissists, opportunists? Yep. Boy, they're running a mile a minute. They better watch where they're running because they can run into some ditches and holes and lose credibility. In any case, we're going to deal with that tomorrow. Also, we're going to deal with what's wrong with our democracy and capitalism. They are incompatible in their current state and have been for some time. When were they compatible? How is it best used? We'll have that on Wednesday. Now, people are not just sitting by their, their radios or even by the internet. A lot of people, we're talking about a lot of people, download or listen to the show live. Let me give those two numbers. So no matter where you're at, you can call in this number, go to the archives and download it. Any five programs with just one phone call. That number again, our archive. So if you miss a program, you can download it. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Now, we start with the latest on health and healing, and also my final part, part three, on corruption of science and the end of civilization, will be today. The entire article, with all of its footnotes and references, is there. Please download these articles and share them. Tomorrow, I'll be doing a special report on vaccines. And also, I'll be reading you tomorrow a letter by a professor at Harvard University, School of Medicine, to Jimmy Wales and Wikipedia. And he seems to be finding the same problems that we found. So this campaign to stop the injustice at Wikipedia is now commencing. And before the people say, well, it doesn't matter, you better take a careful understanding of what it means to be off the mainstream radar. It doesn't mean that we don't exist. It means that we don't need to bring attention to ourselves in the same way that people who are rather vacuous need constant attention. We have a lot of Lady Gagas who have talent. Maybe they're just so insecure. They're scientists who have some ideas. Maybe they're insecure and they have put down other people. And we have a lot of put-downs in society. People can tell you what they're against. Rarely can they tell you what they've done to change the problem to a solution. That's what we like to do. And we'll be doing that today, tomorrow, and on Thursday. Three original in-depth investigative reports just this week. But we always start with health. And this is from Konkuk University in South Korea. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients, and it's about vitamin C. And here, vitamin C shows promises brain aging treatment. A study just reported this week in the Journal of Nutrients reveals a protective role for supplementing with vitamin C, not just because it's an antioxidant, but because it goes beyond that and it helps reduce oxidative stress. And that's what's important. So if you want to reduce oxidative stress, if you want to protect your brain, this study shows vitamin C is one way of doing it. Then the factor is how much vitamin C is enough. Now, I not only studied the science behind vitamin C, I've done clinical studies on vitamin C. And it all started with a conversation I had with a Dr. Stone. And it was a Dr. Stone who inspired Linus Pauling to start looking at vitamin C. So Stone preceded Pauling, and Dr. Albertson Georgie, who I interviewed, the Nobel Prize winner, who actually discovered ascorbic acid, vitamin C, and won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for it, he inspired Stone. So I'm connected to all three of these people, going clear back to when it was the discoverer and the person who started doing the research on it, and that led, though he never got credit, led to Linus Pauling using it, and then it kind of stopped. And that's unfortunate, because vitamin C is our single most important nutrient. And I was up on my farm, upstate New York, at the Fertiller Farm, which was an animal sanctuary, plus it was an organic teaching farm and a homestead, and the first co-op up there, the High Falls Co-op, we started from there. And I got a call from Dr. Stone, and he said, I understand you've been working with people with high-dose vitamin C and getting good results. I said, yes. He said, well, I don't know, is this the same amount of vitamin C that Dr. Frederick Klenner down in, I think it was Reidsville, North Carolina, was doing? I said, no, it's 500% higher. He said, well, that's a lot of vitamin C. I said, well, I created a concept called the law of compensation. To the degree that you have an imbalance of any type, you must exceed the imbalance. You must go beyond the imbalance in order to change the dominant energies. What are you talking about? So it was one of the first conversations I had with a fellow scientist on the idea that we are more than matter. We are more than atoms that are predetermined with genetic messages to be absolutely to the letter on what they're supposed to do. They're very pliable and they can change depending upon what you give the DNA. Hence, if you have the breast cancer gene, but no breast cancer, whether or not you would ever develop breast cancer in and of itself is problematic. But more importantly, if you did good things, if you didn't smoke or drink or eat garbage, if you exercised, dealt with stress, if you took in a lot of healthy nutrients, you could reverse the outcome of that genetic predisposition. And he said, well, what is the base of this? I said, well, I did a study. And the study was based upon a hypothesis of where I come from in West Virginia and all throughout the South. There are a group of doctors never getting publicity. It's just something at a local level. And these doctors will sit with you when you're sick. And they sit and they pray and hold your hand. And people can say, but that's nice. That's friendly. But it's more than that, because there's something exchanged. And then I looked at the scientific literature and found there were actually good studies showing that prayer helps healing, even when a person's not aware they're being prayed for. And there are not just one study, there's several studies on this. But we have all experienced things that cannot be explained by pure reductionist linear thinking. There's only so far logic can take you. Then we have to go into a realm that is considered non-scientific, and that is beliefs and the power of beliefs. And I said, so I want to put it to the test scientifically. And so I got a group of people together who claimed that they could work with cancer at some spiritual level, though they all had different views. One was a rabbi from Brooklyn, and another was a medical doctor, Dr. Thomas Kruth. Another was a chiropractor, Morty Jacobs. Another was a scientist, head of nursing, NYU, Dolores Krieger, and Rabbi Abraham Wiseman. And so they, there was one other, Dr. Krieger. So they all tried, and they, it worked. 45 people didn't succeed, but these did. And they did it 6 out of 6 times, which means part of science is, can you reproduce it? And I stepped aside after the second one and let other scientists like Dr. Berman and others actually conduct the study using the exact protocol, and they came out with the exact same results. They were able to cure the mice with cancer. So I said, the only thing that could have caused that to happen is an energy exchange, and hence the idea of exchanging energy or energy transfer. And I did a whole series of energy transfer experiments in the 1970s, early 70s, right up through the 90s, for over 20 years. And that is the basis of it. So I said, so if you have a problem, any problem, that problem will be the dominant theme in your life. If a person is sick with cancer or emphysema or pain, that becomes the dominant energy. Now, you can function, you can do other things, you can think, talk, have conversations, laugh, but always there is this dominant energy, and it's the dominant energy, the primary energy, that will cause all other energies to be subordinated. Not forgotten, not totally eliminated, but they are no longer dominant. So to reverse the case of the disease, you have to first reverse the power of the energy that's controlling all of your genetic actions. Your genetic actions then manifesting your biochemistry and your body structure. And by the way, now we know that the brain is so, it has such plasticity that it's able to physically change. Historically, we said that's not possible. Whatever the brain is when you're born, that's what you have when you die. Same with the heart. Now we know none of that is true. None of it. They actually were engaged in junk science back then. And these are all really newer developments, even though we've had other countries like China talk about, you know, having too much anger and how that impacts your kidneys and your kidney chi and your liver chi and your digestive. And now we can correlate that that was actually accurate. So what we were ignorant of for 5,000 years, our ignorance, not theirs, they had a reality that we didn't understand because we didn't understand the principle of energies and the energy of a particular herb, the energy of a food, the energy of an emotion. We just assumed it couldn't be real. It had to be of no scientific value. Well, that's our hubris and arrogance, not their reality. So what I saw was with people with advanced diseases, at that time cancer, and acute liver disease, and they would always die, by changing the energy in the person, all energy, and creating a new dynamic dominant energy of health, happiness, joy, spirituality, then all the choices would be one coming from a positive mindset. Coming from a positive mindset, you're then empowering the dominant energy, and then all other energies, including depression, anxiety, fear, insecurity, all those would become subordinate. They could still be there. They could resurface, but not when that dominant energy. And so that's what I found. And that supported previous work that I had seen. And then I did a series of studies and showed that that was the case. And hence I called this new phenomena the laws of compensation. To the degree that you have any imbalance in your life, you must exceed that imbalance with something that is more powerful, healing, positive, and then watch the changes, and they can be very quick. So that was that. In any case, once I started explaining how I was able to get good results with vitamin C, and later some phenomenal results with vitamin C at 200,000 milligrams a day with AIDS, and reversed the AIDS in a number of individuals. And to my knowledge, these are the only cases in world history where full-blown and ARC patients, meaning people with AIDS-defining illnesses and all the symptoms, not only reversed their symptoms, but reversed the disease and went to HIV negative and normal white blood cell count, came back. This is all fully medically documented. And instead of anyone in the AIDS community saying thank you, they began an attack campaign because the certain small little groups were aligned with the pharmaceutical company and some big bucks were going their way. That is still a story that the American media, especially the liberal media, have been utter cowards in exposing these people, their organizations, and how hundreds of thousands of people with AIDS-defining illnesses died because of the AZT, the medication they were given, the politics behind that, the hate campaign against anyone who was challenging it, including in the AIDS community, including the gay community. They destroyed Charles Ortlieb, one of the most courageous publishers in the history of gay publishing. He had the New York Native and their editors and journalists. It was just a scorched earth. So it had nothing to do about curing AIDS. We did that. It had to do with not exposing the pharmaceutical industry, with putting money in everyone's pocket. And that nobody wanted to expose. Anyhow, that's for a different story. So from that, I was sitting there, and something just occurred to me. I'm looking at a goat where I'm on having this conversation, and goats on a farm, if you know, they'll eat anything. They'll eat poison ivy, poison oak, and they never get sick, and they never get cancer, or at least I've never seen one get cancer, and I've had a lot of goats. And so then we decided to do a serum test, and we wanted to see how much vitamin C does a goat weighing about 20 pounds produce in a day, in order to stay vitally healthy. And it was over 20,000 milligrams. Now, they have the capacity with glucose in the liver to create vitamin C. We don't. We have to get it from our food. And we started off with bad science. You know, the idea that if you prevented scurvy, a classical symptom in sailors, or those who were away from any fresh food sources and hence weren't getting vitamin C on a regular basis, they would end up with bleeding gums, teeth falling out, rickets, and skin lesions, fatigue, liver failure, scurvy. So by putting limes and lime juice on ships, they overcame classical scurvy, and they thought they had done a great thing. Well, that was a good thing, no question about that. But now think for a moment. Just stop and wrap your mind around this. And this is just one reason why I have so little confidence in health sciences as being anything other than monotheistic. The difference between preventing a classical deficiency, which is an extreme deficiency, and just getting enough so you no longer manifest the classical deficiency does not mean that you're optimally well. That's a huge difference between, you know, 100 milligrams of vitamin C to prevent scurvy a day versus 200,000 milligrams to reverse end-stage cancers and end-stage AIDS. And the idea is if they don't see a disease as a classically defined one, then they have no protocols for preventative protocols for disease. It's just not taught. And if it is, the amounts are so ridiculously and simplistically limited, you couldn't keep a cockroach healthy with what the average physician suggests they eat in the way of vitamins. 1.6 milligrams of B1, 1.2 milligrams of B2. Just stupid. I mean, beyond stupid. That's how stupid science is. And yet they're not supposed to be stupid, and yet they are. Doctors are not supposed to be greedy, yet many are. They're supposed to know that the medications they're giving you aren't going to hurt you, and yet they do. So we have to distinguish a person's intent and the body of knowledge they're using for their protocols versus the outcome. And so from this, Stone wrote some pieces, Linus Pauling got involved, and then Pauling came out to see me. And there was a Dr. Robert Cathcart in California who was working with Kaposi sarcoma at the time and getting good results. And I had not known Linus Pauling 12 years before he even AIDS was identified, or HIV was identified as the probable cause of AIDS at a French restaurant in Bethesda, New Maryland, by Robert Gatto, one of the most egregiously self-interested individuals in all of science. In fact, when he was on my radio program with Luc Montagnier, he hung up on me when I asked him just a simple, honest question, and couldn't handle that. In any case, so Pauling started to use the same principle, and this is where it came from, by the way, for fighting the common cold. And he believed that 18,000 milligrams to 20,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C could help prevent the cold. And it was based upon the principles of compensation, meaning if you've got a cold, your immune system is challenged, and you've got to exceed what challenged it. And to exceed what challenged it, you're going to have to take an awful lot of vitamin C. So he was able to do wonders and founded the Linus Pauling Research Institute. They were using high dose of vitamin C and quercetin, and millions of people were able to prevent colds or shorten the duration of the cold and flu using vitamin C. Now, he in his own way was monotheistic. Not that he was a single-minded person. He was the only American that I'm aware of to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes. And one was in chemistry. But when I suggested try things other than vitamin C, he did look at cancer. But he didn't go up high enough. He should have given him and Dr. Cameron at the Vale of Leven Hospital in Scotland, should have been giving the patients with terminal cancer as high as they could, as high until it started spilling in the urine. And that's the way you measure it, not by an upset stomach or diarrhea. A lot of people say, I can't take any more vitamin C. I've already reached my bowel tolerance. No, you haven't. What you've reached is you've reached taking vitamin C as straight as ascorbic acid and having that hit your hydrochloric acid in the stomach, and that creates a hyperacidic reaction, and that creates diarrhea. Now, some people could hit that with 1,000 milligrams. Well, if you have a serious illness, 1,000 milligrams is not going to do diddly squat. But did you take the vitamin C in a smoothie with protein, which would have buffered it? And if you buffered the vitamin C and if you took it as ascorbate, you could take a lot. In fact, at a lecture before a group of physicians, I asked them for a challenge. I knew one of the guys was opposed to, you know, the oral vitamin C. So I took a jar of vitamin C and I passed it around so they all saw that it was vitamin C and how much was in it per milligram. And I said, well, I have so much confidence in vitamin C and how to take it that I'm going to be continuing every 10 minutes of this discussion to take a teaspoon of vitamin C. And that's exactly what I did. I took tens of thousands of milligrams. Now, I'm not suggesting this for anyone else, but there was no upset stomach, no diarrhea, nothing. So one of the physicians began to do the same thing in his own office, and about a week later he called me and said, you know, you're right. He said, my sinuses cleared up, and this puffiness under my eyes cleared up, and he said, I feel a whole lot better, and I don't have that achiness I used to have. And he said, I've been telling my patients to take only 500 milligrams a day, and wow, was I wrong. I should be giving him a lot more than that. So the bottom line to all this is that when you see what vitamin C can do, and in this statement they're saying it helps brain aging, imagine how the brain ages by oxidative stress. So anything that can stop oxidative stress or lessen it, and that's vitamin C, is going to help oxidative stress in your lungs, your heart, your muscles, your eyes, your skin. Everything is going to be healthier longer because of this principle. And that's what they found in just this one journal here, the journal Nutrients, about vitamin C and oxidative stress. Now, from the University of Copenhagen, psychological distress is a risk factor for dementia. A new study suggests that vital exhaustion, which can be perceived as an indicator of psychological distress, is a risk factor for future risk of dementia. That means that when you're chronically stressed, let's say you don't You don't like your home life. You don't like your work life. You have problems in your life that cannot be resolved. That creates chronic stress. And that leads to what is known as vital exhaustion. It's operationalized as feelings of unusual fatigue and increased irritability and demoralization, and can be considered an indicator for psychological distress. And vital exhaustion is suggested to be a response to unresolved problems in an individual's life, in particular when being incapable of adapting to prolonged exposure to stressors, meaning you're in a bad relationship and it's never going to get any better. And you know it, but you're afraid to leave the relationship. What this is telling us is that when we perceive stress that is going to be chronic and sticking with us because for some reason we can't change something, then we create stress hormones that go up and they stay up. And that creates inflammation in the brain. It also creates inflammation in our heart. Cardiovascular risk factors are well-known modifiable risk factors for dementia. And anytime you're under stress, you're prematurely aging all of your organs, but especially your brain and your heart. So one more reason to engage in constructive stress reduction. And from Niigata University in Japan comes a new study about the boysenberry. Boy, B-O-Y, sen, S-E-N, B-E-R-R-I-E-S, boysenberries. And they help maintain vascular stability. And that's important because that's your endothelial function, and to help prevent diseases, diabetes and heart disease. And they discovered in their study that boysenberry polyphenols and its anthocyanidins can inhibit blood and lymphatic vessel dysfunction and help keep your vascular system stable. And you've heard me mention many times the endothelium, endo, E-N-D-O, thelium, T-H-E-L-I-A-L. It's also known as blood and lymphatic vessels. And cells play an important role in the maintenance of vascular homeostasis. However, the aging process as we do it today, and age-related disorders like diabetes and hypertension and obesity, induce endothelial dysfunction. In turn, endothelial dysfunction increases the risk of atherosclerosis and earlier death. So, simply taking a serving of boysenberry, a serving is a cup, a boysenberry, you can make a big difference and protect yourself from having a heart attack, stroke, and protect your heart rate, systemic glucose levels, systolic and diastolic blood pressure. All those are benefited. And finally, from Mashhad University in Iran and Tokhaku Institute of Technology in Japan comes a study about black seed oil. You've heard me mention black cumin seed oil. It's effective against everything imaginable. In this case, it's effective in treating Alzheimer's and ischemic organ damage. But mind you, this is a centuries-old healing agent, Nigellia sativa, or a.k.a. black cumin seeds in the oil. And the oil is pressed from the black seeds. And there are thousands of studies now on it in the peer-reviewed literature. And two published journal articles looked at how black seed can heal organs, ischemic damage, and prevent or help Alzheimer's disease. And they're both very positive. So if you have a problem with ischemia, and that occurs when an organ is not receiving enough blood for its ability to function properly, and most of us are familiar with ischemic-induced strokes, which comprise an estimated 80% of all strokes, a clot, collapsed blood vessel, or some other inhibiting factor stops the blood flow into the brain tissue, and those tissue collapse or are damaged from a lack of oxygen. But other organs have ischemic issues as well. And since this is, you know, since this is something we never talk about in our society, yes, your brain, your heart, your liver, and your kidneys can also have ischemic episodes. So black cumin seed oil, I suggest preventatively, 1 teaspoon mixed in. Now, can you take it? I take it straight. 99% of people should not take it straight. You take it in a smoothie. because it's a little strong. And it can also help with the amyloid beta, which is the stuff that makes up the recognizable brain plaque that forms with Alzheimer's disease. And what are called pluripotent stem cells are able to manifest into cells that form all of the body's tissues, and they are usually obtained from human embryonic sources. And cholinergic refers to that which liberates or activates acetylcholine, which is a vital neuron transmitter of the nervous system in the brain. And here comes black cumin seed oil. And there are dozens of similar studies, and it makes a difference helping all these systems in the body to re-regulate them and to protect you. We're going to take a break. We're halfway through our program, 30 minutes in, but I want to give you a deeper, more measured answer so people understand why it is that I will choose something in a protocol where others would say, well, I would never give that much. Well, they've never gotten the results either, have they? So it's just we have to have a whole new mindset when it comes to public health science, because the community is out there acting like they're going across the country in a Conestoga wagon, and it's going to be a rough trip. Yeah, you don't have to do it that way. They just choose to. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
We got it together, didn't we? We've definitely got our thing together, don't we? Isn't that nice? I mean, really, when you really sit and think about it, isn't it really, really nice? I can easily bless nobody but you.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Tomorrow, I'm going to also be sharing the Consortium News article by Caitlin Johnstone about narrative control firm targeting alternative media. NewsGuard is led by some of the most virulently pro-imperialist individuals in America, and its agenda is to shore up narrative control for the ruling power establishment. What's that mean? Well, it means all alternative spokespersons, organizations are being discredited and discounted because these people want to control everything, and they're succeeding. So we'll deal with that. But right now I want to complete our series. This is part three of Corruption of Science and the End of Civilization. The ancient Greek physician Hippocrates, he was the father of modern medicine, stated, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." Unfortunately, this millennium-old tenet was forgotten long ago. Enter the agrochemical giant Monsanto, which has its finger in the majority of food-produced items in the United States and around the world. Monsanto has become notorious for relying upon a wide network of ghostwriting resources to intentionally undermine governments, regulatory agencies, and deceive the public. That is my opinion. The company has made a habit of contracting public relations firms and wooing compromise writers for over a decade. Following a California court ruling in favor of a plaintiff who developed cancer, the company's flagship weed-killing chemical glyphosate, trade name Roundup, is under growing international scrutiny as a carcinogen. Monsanto again is relying upon its army of ghost rider goons to conduct damage control. Journalist Carrie Gillum has been tracking Monsanto's shenanigans for many years. In 2016, the journal Critical Review of Toxicology published a special series of science articles reviewing glyphosate's carcinogenic potential. The World Health Organization had already ruled the chemical might cause cancer, and European health officials were seriously deliberating on banning the herbicide from the continent. what was called the four independent panels from the journal declared, quote, neither any Monsanto company employee nor any attorneys reviewing any of the expert panel's manuscripts prior to submission to the journal, end quote. However, Gilliam's investigation into the manuscripts released during the litigation found this was a complete lie. One of Monsanto's leading scientists not only reviewed the manuscripts, but also edited them. In one internal email within the company, the chief of regulatory science had admitted he reviewed an entire document with suggestions for omissions and a few edits on his own. Other internal documents identified ghostwriters and strategies for recruiting outside scientists to compose articles, giving the weed killer credibility. Attempts to have the papers retracted from the journal have yet to be heeded. So think of that. Their very standards of objectivity were shredded, yet they continued to let the articles be and be published. Besides ghostwriters, corporations hide behind shadowy nonprofit organizations, front groups, and shill think tanks that project the public image of being legitimate and expert scientific institutions. This strategy has been a means to covertly get corporate messages out under the illusion of being generated by independent scientists. For example, a flurry of studies have appeared in recent years proving that sugar-loaded sodas and beverages are substantially contributing to the nation's obesity and type 2 diabetes crisis. This message is reaching the public. Soda consumption has dropped by 25%. To counter the scientific assault on its revenues, Coca-Cola, the world's largest manufacturer of junk sugary beverages, teamed up with a corporate-sponsored nonprofit called the Global Energy Balance Network to promulgate the message that weight-conscious Americans are overly fixated on how much they eat and drink while not paying enough attention to exercise. The group, which has recruited many prominent scientists and health professionals, swears by its independence from Coke's influence. All right? Should we believe them? They say no influence. Is that true? However, our research has found that Coke started the nonprofit initiative with a $1.5 million startup donation. And since its founding, the partnership has unleashed a media blitz across the medical journals and professional conferences and mainstream media and social networks to get Coca-Cola's message out. New York University professor of nutrition and food science, Marianne Nestle, has labeled this group as, quote, nothing but a front group for Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola agenda is very clear. Get these researchers to confuse the science and deflect attention away from dietary intake. While it's easy to blame private industry for producing the junk science appearing in peer-reviewed journals, we mustn't lose sight of the corruption within the publications and among senior editors as well. The reason is simple. There are far too many financial incentives for professional journals to approve and publish corporate-funded research. An article confirming the therapeutic value of a new drug, for example, can go a long way to bring enormous revenues to publishers. And pharmaceutical firms will order thousands of copies of the article to be disseminated throughout their sales force and sent to physicians and medical schools and clinics and hospitals. The Lancet, one of the most respected medical publications in the world, receives 41% of its income from reprints purchased by drug companies. The American Medical Association's journal, the Journal of the American Medical Association, gets a whopping 53% of its income from Big Pharma and doing the same. And finally, Big Pharma engages in a form of bribery to get journal editors to ensure their research gets into print. Jessica Liu at the University of Toronto's Medical School conducted an analysis of payments U.S. drug makers made to 713 editors employed by 52 high-impact medical journals. 50% of those editors were identified as playing this corporate game and receiving payments for services that included preferential treatment towards article submission, and appointing peer reviewers. Lou and her colleagues estimated that the mean payment for general articles was $28,100. For research submissions, $37,900. The worst example is the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Now listen carefully. This is fully documented. All of its 35 editors were on the take. Cumulatively, the journal's editors received almost $15 million in what you might consider, or what I believe are bribes, from Big Pharma. And yet this is considered normal, but it's hidden from the public. So let's look at corporate control of the scientific information. Private corporations have full and complete control over the proprietary research and trial data in their possession. This means they have the discretion to decide what data to release. In the case of the pharmaceutical industry, the U.S. government makes no demands for a company to release all of its clinical trial data and results for any given drug or vaccine submitted to the FDA or CDC, respectively, for approval and licensure. So if they have a lot of bad studies, they don't have to submit those. This is also true for what is called selective publication of studies in medical journals. In 2008, the French multinational pharmaceutical company Sanofi completed 92 studies on drugs in their pipeline. Only 14 were submitted and approved for publication. What should we think about the remaining 78 trials that were withheld? Clearly, it would be foolish for financial reasons alone that Sanofi would want its negative trial results to appear in peer-reviewed literature. The professional medical community and institutions rely heavily upon the scientific publications to keep abreast of the latest studies and news. Nevertheless, federal authorities would not require Sanofi nor any pharmaceutical firm to submit research data that might jeopardize its approval on issues of safety and serious adverse effects and clinical efficacy. Consequently, federal reviewers are only being provided with trials and data favorable to Big Pharma's bottom line. Dr. Stephen Nissen is a highly respected cardiologist at the prestigious Cleveland Clinic who worries about the demise of independent research outside of the pharmaceutical control. And among the targets he has investigated is Glaxo's blockbuster diabetes drug, Avendia. Unable to acquire original patent information from the drug maker, the good doctor turned to the internet and, quote, stumbled upon a cache of data belonging to Glaxo, end quote, which had been submitted during a lawsuit filed by former New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. In addition to discovering that only 15 of 42 clinical trials of Avendia had been published, the company had been suppressing the data that the drug increased risks of heart attack by 43%. Dr. Nissen published his findings in the New England Journal of Medicine. 2 days later, the FDA slapped a black box warning on the drug. So why did it take an independent scientist to do this and not anyone at the FDA or CDC or the National Institutes of Health? That's how corrupt the system is. Dr. Nissen also uncovered a story about Glaxo's antidepressant drug Paxil that was equally disturbing. The company's research had shown that children on Paxil were twice as likely to have suicidal thoughts than kids taking a placebo. Nevertheless, Glaxo had withheld this information from health officials and the medical community. However, Dr. Neeson's challenge is not in there. Among the deplorable tactics corporations adopt to protect their commercial interest, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, is, quote, scientific coercion. This includes harassing scientists and institutions that bring to light corporate misconduct and malfeasance or raise obstacles to the revenue flow. Companies will go a long way to silence their opponents in the scientific community, including litigation threats and putting pressure upon institutions and universities to impose demotions, loss of tenure, or blatant censorship. In retaliation, Glaxo let loose its attack dogs to defame and discredit Dr. Neeson. The hitmen included individuals, I won't mention their names today because we're doing separate independent investigative reports on each one, but there's a group of them. In fact, an FDA consultant was one of them. Scathing articles against Dr. Neeson appeared in the Washington Times, Nature, and Clinical Practice Cardiovascular Medicine. A caustic email was also sent out to the wider media deriding Dr. Neeson's credibility. Other stories include direct covert bribing of country's health officials to get sympathetic support for a drug approval. This was the case when Eli Lilly, and wasn't it our former vice president, Dan Quayle, who was on their board, bribed Swedish officials to get its antidepressant drug Prozac approved. Dr. John Virapin, a former Eli Lilly executive in sales, blew the whistle, good for him, after personally bribing the Swedes. In 2012, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission slapped the company with a $29 million settlement for bribing government officials in Russia, Brazil, China, and Poland through offshore accounts to push its antipsychotic drug Zyprexia and an antidepressant, also Cymbalta. The corporate leader in 2013 repeated a similar crime, bribing Chinese physicians to start prescribing Prozac. These are only a few. We have dozens of examples. We have thousands of lawsuits that we have originally researched, and we'll be doing more on how corrupt is Big Pharma, how corrupt is Big Finance. We did. I hired two lawyers full-time for a year, one handling all the lawsuits out of Wall Street, one handling all the lawsuits that were settled out of Big Pharma, and it's just one giant cesspool. People are not aware of this. Remember, I'm only giving you some small examples, but then again, these have been extensively reported by some investigative journalists, but not in mainstream media. We mustn't take lightly the extreme measures private corporations will descend into in order to silence critics and remove barriers to maximizing their economic bottom line. But then they manipulate the media. I was fortunate for my entire career never once to be censored in the mainstream media. When I was on ABC for 12 years and ABC Network as well, radio, corporations that I would challenge, like the meat industry, all they would descend upon the head of the sales, who would then go to the program director, and the program director would say, "We have evidence. Gary provides us with documentation that is credible of everything that he says. So too bad." So because we had people who had high levels of consciousness, were ethical, that never happened. But imagine all the people who've had shows canceled or never got anywhere in any media, or a good reporter for a good publication who had to spike a story, or someone spiked a story, or change the story. And Cheryl Atkinson, formerly of CBS, has many things to say about the politics of stopping reporters from telling the full story. So turning to any major television network, we inevitably find advertisements for pharmaceutical drugs. Even the drugs that are being promoted tell us something about the network's viewing audience. Middle years and older, who are aging and at a higher disease rate, are more receptive to the drugs being shilled in their eyes and ears. There's no law that prevents the mainstream media from taking fees to advertise products from the pharmaceutical industry, but there's only two countries do it, New Zealand and America. What we are less clear about are the contractual conditions between the private advertisers and the networks over journalists reporting health news or negative findings about the specific drugs being plugged in the ads. And because the United States and New Zealand governments actually permit drug advertising on television networks, so this is once again an example of the special relationship that exists between federal agencies and the drug companies. Big Pharma had to first succeed in seducing federal FCC officials to win access to America's airwaves. In 2016, the FDA had a major announcement and selected a small group of media firms, including National Public Radio, to release the news. But there were conditions, known as close-hold embargoes, that demanded journalists could only interview and ask questions to sources that were officially sanctioned by the federal agencies. Seeking outside comments was forbidden. The FDA's intention is clear: to control the flow of information and assure that press reports are stamped with the agency seal of approval. Upon hearing the FDA's repression of journalistic integrity in the science media, the journal Scientific America filed a Freedom of Information Act request. The publication uncovered the FDA's attempt to mislead the media and public by creating, quote, a courtier of journalists, end quote, who would do the FDA's bidding. These journalists are given the privilege of receiving advance notice about science news before anyone else. Reliable independent journalism relies on pursuing outside sources to receive comments and verification for accuracy. Now, although the FDA claims it had ceased closed-hold embargoes on reporters, the practice has continued unabated and is now embedded in the FDA's media strategy. And many of the medical and health stories coming out of the FDA have followed this principle, and as a result, all the media outlets parrot the same FDA directive. Journalistic watchdogs, according to the article and author, become the FDA's lapdogs. Reporters are then reduced to stenographers. Shortly after the release of the controversial documentary Vaxxed, co-directed by the discredited British physician and GI specialist Andrew Wakefield, we undertook and published our investigation into the shadowy forces pulling mainstream media strings to demonize the film. The film was not intended to be an anti-vaccine diatribe. Rather, it told the true story about a senior vaccine scientist at the Center for Disease Control, Dr. William Thompson, whose guilty conscience motivated him to turn whistleblower. Dr. Thompson released thousands of pages of classified documents to an independent professor who we've had on the show, Brian, and a House of Representatives person, Bill Posey, that contained unquestionable, absolutely verifiable evidence that the CDC had intentionally and with malice aforethought covered up as a criminal act data showing a direct correlation between the MMR vaccine and rising autism rates among African-American boys, as much as a 240% increase in autism in those boys. In fact, Representative Posey spent years trying to get Dr. Thompson to testify under oath before House subcommittee and was constantly blocked by the CDC pressure on his colleagues and other lobbyists. The CDC had committed an enormous crime against the African-American community. If Thompson were permitted to give testimony to the American people, the entire vaccine industry would have become jeopardized. The industry profits and survival are far more important than the lives of small black children. And the media was equally criminal in whitewashing this story. The question we asked ourselves was, how can a film that had not been released for public viewing become the target of such vicious attacks by numerous news outlets within a 72-hour period? In addition, beneath all the media's criticisms, we identified a single suspicious written template that all the journalists had been relying upon for their reports. What might account for this anomaly? Clearly, there was no independent journalism being permitted within ABC, CNN, MSNBC, the UK's Guardian, Time Magazine, The Washington Post, The LA Times, New York Times, Forbes, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, and many others. Nor did any of these journalists ever view the film. The entire case was terrible. Many federal agencies have sophisticated public relations departments. In the case of the CDC, its media activities had more in common with an intelligence operation. seeking an explanation for why so many mainstream journalists could pen identical screeds to denigrate the film that they had never watched, as well as vaccine safety and vaccine autism associations. In general, we identified a joint program between the agency and the Association for Healthcare Journalists, scores of health editors and reporters through the nation's leading mainstream media corporations have passed through the CDC Atlanta's campus through this alliance to be indoctrinated in national public health policies. Journalists who complete the program receive special privileges, including access and instructions to the CDC's surveillance database and publications to assist in their investigative reporting. In addition, these journalists join the CDC's exclusive club and receive advance notices about stories to report, prepare scripts to work from. An example of a CDC script disseminated to these journalists instructs what and how to report collective fear during the influenza season in such a way that people will rush out with their kids to the local pharmacy to get the flu shot. Fearmonger is just one of the many successful strategies to seduce the public into adhering to a specific message that benefits the fearmonger. Monsanto succeeded in this emotional scheme to persuade California's electorate away from voting in favor of GMO labeling by shifting the debate away from GMO health issues to an economic threat that would increase families' food bills. If labeling were to be approved, people voted on their financial rather than their health fears. Political candidates from both parties engage in this practice constantly. Yet perhaps the largest dose of propaganda to generate fear ritually takes place every annual flu season. The media barrage warnings of coming pending death from a flu infection is completely orchestrated out of the CDC, its advisors and consultants, and its broad network of healthcare. In conclusion, ironically, on its website, the CDC vows, quote, to base all public health decisions on the highest quality of scientific data. Nonsense. Yet Dr. Peter Doshi at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine points out, when it concerns the flu vaccine, the CDC's motto couldn't be further from the truth. Among all public health policies, flu vaccination programs are not only the most aggressively forced upon the public, but also the most scientifically deceitful. Dr. Doshi notes that upon close examination of the CDC's flu vaccine policy, quote, although proponents employ the rhetoric of science, the studies underlying the policies are often of low quality and do not substantiate official claims. The vaccine might be less beneficial and less safe than has been claimed, and the threat of influenza appears overstated, end quote. In his evaluation published in the British Medical Journal, the flu vaccine is an example of government, quote, disease mongering. And so there it is. But they still gave out 168 million doses of the vaccine in just one season. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. Our articles with all their supporting footnotes are published on PRN.fm. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. That's right! Get up and boogie.